I'm an alcoholic. If we could get anybody who wants to come listen to the speaker, come on, get a little bit closer up front. Jimmy wants to look you in the eyes.
That's right.
We just wanted to, on behalf, Harry had to go run a quick errand because of we bought coffee cups and nothing, and we ain't got coffee, and so we ain't typical alcoholics. We're getting it done. We'll have cups here shortly. I just wanted to welcome everybody that came out today. There are quite a few people that put some effort into doing this fundraiser today for the conference, Heart of Texas Conference. And those will be shown out later. We planned quite a few things for everybody today. After the speaker, there's a lot to do. We got plenty to eat. We got stuff for the kids to do. We got stuff for the adults to do. We've got a place to get wet over here. Without further ado, here's Jim S. and introduce our speaker.
I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Jimmy D. has been a real friend of ours in the Wakefield Alcoholics Anonymous. He's been down several times. One time he pulled us out of a jam. We had a deal like this, and needed a speaker at the last minute, and he hustled down here from Dallas. Jimmy D's got one of the great stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad to call him my friend, and please give a warm Central Texas welcome to Jimmy D from Dallas. How y'all doing?
I'll get loud up here anyway.
Jimmy Daniels, an alcoholic. I'm pretty wired up on this Starbucks, so should be okay. About a third of the way through it, you know what I mean? I'm alcoholic. That tells you who I am and what I am and where I come from and what I do and where I end up. And if this thing ends up the way it's supposed to be, you're going to be listening to a man that found God. And the way I found God was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found my family. And I found my friends. And I found my life. And I found my dogs. And I love my dogs. And I got a guy, a sponsor, he gave me a chip on my 29th birthday. And he gave me a little book that said, the 400 things you need to know to do. And I turned it into the second page and said, own a dog. So, let me tell you the story of my life. The reason it became so important, let me see what time it is first. Your butt can only, you can only stand what your butt can stand, you know what I mean? Let me turn this off so it don't ring. When I was a little boy, I was living in the housing projects in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was raised in the housing projects in Louisville, Kentucky. And my mother raised, ended up having 10 children. But the first four of us was living then, and I was probably about 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. I can't remember. I don't remember much of my early life. But I remember I found a little pup somewhere. And I brought that little pup in, and I've had the pup downstairs in the hall, and we lived on the second or third floor. Oh, my God, I got me a little puppy, man. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. And that little puppy started squealing in the middle of the night. And in the housing project, you can't have pets. You can't have dogs and cats, or back then, anyway. My mother said, who brought that damn dog in here? And then my brothers and sisters said, Jimmy did it. She said, well, go get him and put him outside. And I had to go get that little dog and put him outside. And it was a really cold winter day. And I cried like a little baby. And you know what that did to me? What that set up for me in my life was I was going to be 54 years old until I thought it was okay for me to own a dog. A kid, that's called alcoholism. And that's called what happens to us on the way to the trip to the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. The book says in two places what we're supposed to talk about from behind this little holy podium up here. And this is a holy place. I try to watch my verbs, my language. Because I come from West Hill. And a lot of you came from there. And most of us, probably 99% of us, you're going to hear a story that's pretty tough up here. But let me say before I get started that I can't put to words how tough it really was. And I'm not going to try to tell a tougher story than you people, because most of us, your life was as bad as mine before I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And we all came from West Hill. And we all came from pain and confusion. And it just didn't work for us. My mother came from a little town called Central City, Kentucky. And I was raised in that little, I was born in a little town right outside of Central City, Kentucky, called Mormon, Kentucky. And the population back then was, I think, 76. And I don't remember much of my early life, but I remember what I was told and heard about my mother's early life. My mother left home when she was about 16 years old, and she started having babies when she was about 17 or 18. And I don't know where she lived, but she lived around and she lived in places. And the first thing I knew that it was important was my mother was living in the housing projects with four children. I think she was 22 years old. And my mother was living on welfare. And so my mother told me this bad story about how she was treated as a child. And she was treated really, really bad. Really bad. Really sad story. Really ugly story. And a really wounded, wounded story. My mother was a very wounded woman. The first thing I remember of being alive was that I was living in a housing project in Louisville, Kentucky, and probably the first thing that I need to talk about, because it's about addiction and because it's about isms, is that I remember that I started smoking cigarettes when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And the reason I was able to start smoking cigarettes is I smoked cigarettes with a bunch of little other little kids that was going to the 7th or 8th grade or whatever, 6th or 7th grade, 5th grade, whatever, we start smoking. And all of us start smoking. And why do we start smoking? There wasn't anybody to keep us from smoking. Nobody to stop us from smoking, because all the ladies in the housing projects are raising kids and the daddies are all gone. We got any housing project kids here? We got one I know of. Would you give me a big hug when I come in? There she is. Yeah, that's a different life, believe me. And so I started smoking cigarettes. The next thing I started doing was that I didn't like people. I didn't like my friends, and I couldn't tell the truth, because the truth was so ugly that I just couldn't spit it out. And I was always ashamed of who I was as a little boy. I was really ashamed of who I was. I was ashamed at school. I was ashamed to take lunch tickets because other kids could pay for their lunch. I was ashamed about everything. Ashamed of the shoes I had on. I always thought the pretty girls could see all the way down through my soul and see the cardboard in my shoes. So shame, shame, shame. I started drinking alcohol when I was about 13 or 14 years old. The thing we did in the housing projects, we sent usually old black men or old poor white trash men to get us wine and to get us beer from the liquor store. All you had to do was buy them a pint of wine, they'd get you whatever you wanted. And so we're out getting drunk when we're 14, 15, 16 years old. Now how can we do that? We tell our mothers we were staying out all night with each other at the other parents' house, and you didn't have telephones back then. And so we'd come home drunk the next day and go to bed, and nobody knew any difference, you know. And probably the ism, the first time it really, really, really stuck its ugly head up in my life was when I was probably 15 years old. And we were struck with being cool when I was 15 years old. All us guys quit school when we were 15 years old. And we thought we knew everything. And the reason we quit school was because there wasn't anybody to make us go to school. All boys that aren't mentored don't do well. And so we weren't mentored. And we used to go to a dance at the neighborhood house. And it was the neighborhood dance, and they played rock and roll records. And, of course, you know, we wore peg pants and had ducktails. And, you know, whatever it was, whatever, if you're an alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about. You had, you had to be the coolest one when you were a teenager. I know that. And I saw this girl. And I said, oh, my God, what is that? And she looked at me, and I looked away. And I looked back, and I couldn't look in her eyes. And so I didn't know what to do. I went home, and I couldn't. That's all I could think about. So I went home, and I tattooed her name on my leg. And she said, one day at the next neighborhood house dance, she said, are you the guy that's got my name on your leg? I said, yeah, that would be me. She said, can I see it? I said, sure. I showed her my name. And her name is Georgetta. And I said, you want to see my other one? She said, you got two? I said, yeah. She said, what's that say down there? I said, that says born to lose. She said, well, why did you put that on your forehead? I said, I don't know. That's what we did. We just do stuff like that. Can you guys put tattoos on you when you're a teenager? There you go. There's one. There's two, three, four. Four. And they're all those old jailhouse tattoos. Really ugly. Really ugly tattoos. I got to tell you a story about them a little later on. So she became my first girlfriend, Georgetta. Now what we do, we get behind next to her house, and she lived in a project. She lived right across the street from the project. So I had a girl that was highfalutin. She was didn't live in the project. That was really cool, you know. Because the girls live in the housing project, they were trash just like we were, you know. So we went together. We'd get between this house and we'd kiss. And she had great big lips. And we'd kiss, man, for about an hour or two every night. And then we'd go home. That's all we did, you know. We'd go home, think about what we're going to get to kiss tomorrow night, you know. And I remember telling my story in AA when I first told it. And I told people how I fell in love with Georgetta. And all the old timers said, it wasn't love, man. And you know what I tell those old timers back then? I said, you didn't kiss her, man, so you don't know. And I just loved Georgetta, but I kept breaking up with her. Why did we break up with them? Who in the hell knows why? I don't know why. But I broke up with her one time too many, and she left me. And she left me with a guy, for a guy that was about 18 or 19 and just got out of prison. And he had a 49 Ford or a 49 Mercury with a chop top. And I went down to try to see her, and she was getting in that car, and I had a 58 Schwinn. And so I missed the cut. I think that poverty has really struck me, and I'm really having a rough time in life. The poverty couldn't touch the pain from the girl and I breaking up. There's been never, ever, ever been any kind of pain in my life like the pain of broken relationships when we think we're in love, or maybe we are in love. And that separating. It's like trying to get two Siamese twins away from each other. And it's part of the isms of alcohol. I got a job as an errand boy in the dental laboratory when I was 15 years old, and I was delivering false teeth. And then I put a little rock and roll band together when I was 19, and I was doing really well. I was making money with my little band, and I met the prettiest girl in the housing projects. And then I had moved to the second housing project because my mother had another baby and she's running from the welfare. And me and this young girl, we decided to put our money together and get out of the housing projects and just find a way to live other than living in the housing projects. And so I got out of the housing project.
projects, and I got married at 19, and by the time I was 20 years old, I crossed the line in the book, the imaginary line they talk about, but when I got over that line, I was never going to get to come back over this way. And that, kids, is that line called alcoholism. And I didn't know it, my wife didn't know it, but she was married to a real alcoholic. And I came from a place where you did drugs. We had needles in our arms. And it just went with the territory. If you came from there, you'd have had them in your arms too. And by the time I was in my early 20s, I had three children, Dory, Petey, and Melissa. And by the time I was on my way to prison for the first time for cashing somebody else's income tax return check, I was 24, 25 years old. And I didn't know what happened to me. And I remember I went to jail for cashing this income tax return check. Now, let me tell you how much it was for. I think it's about $80. I thought it was $300-something for years until I went down to the federal building and got my papers after I got sober. And I had federal papers where it says, the United States of America versus James Roy Daniels. Forgery. And I thought, man, that's a hell of a lot of people versus one person, United States of America. And I went to jail, and while I was in jail, I escaped from jail. And because I was a federal prisoner, they called that a federal penitentiary. And I looked at the other thing that said, the United States of America versus James B. Daniels. The charge? Escape from federal penitentiary. And I escaped from that place, and it was downtown Louisville. And I was telling Jim, when I was a kid, I knew Cassius Clay. Y'all know him as Muhammad Ali. And he just run around downtown like all us kids did. You know, he's just another kid, wore combat boots and flak jacket. And he come from a neighborhood that's probably not real poor, but it's pretty poor. He had a brother named Rudy. And I spent a couple of nights out drunk with his father from halfway all night after hours places two times. And I'm in jail, and I thought, man, what's a nice guy like me going to jail for? I mean, what happened, you know? And I think when I was a kid, me and my brother, man, we had, you know, we back then, the only thing a kid had was Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. And I loved Gene Autry, and he loved Roy Rogers, and so we were arguing all the time, you know. And I'm a loner. If you're an alcoholic, you're probably a loner. And I thought, I love Gene Autry, man, because it's only him and Champion. Man, one day I'm going to get me a horse, and I'm going to name it Champion. And Roy Rogers had a buddy named Pat Buttram. He had a dog named Bullet. They had a Jeep. He had a wife named Dale Evans. And he had a horse, you know. And so my brother always got me because Roy had so much stuff. Now, I'm getting ready to be transferred to a federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, after they caught me from escaping from their prison. And I escaped from the prison. They caught everybody but me in 15 days. And there were 15 of us that escaped, and I stayed out about 8 months, 6 or 8 months. They caught me in Columbus, Ohio, and I was up there, and I told the doctor I was a dental technician, and by the time he found out I wasn't, and I was a hard worker, so he kept me working as a dental technician. And they caught me up there, and they brought me back, and I got some more time for case. And I went to penitentiary, and I remember I was on the way to prison from the Louisville jail that I had escaped from. And I remember saying, and the marshals won't talk to you. I started trying to talk to them. They said, shut up, man. We're not allowed to talk to you. I said, that's not very nice. They said, shut up anyway, you know. You know how we are. We like to piss them off, you know. I used to try to piss off the old timers, but, you know, I don't do it anymore because I've become one. I'm going to make you laugh if it's the last thing I do. That girl walking away, I'm going to make her laugh. She won't look at me. There you go. What's your name? Michael? Hey, Michael. Wow. That girl's name's Michael. Hey, but dig it, man. There was a boy named Sue. You know what I mean?
listening to a little rat from the housing projects in Louisville, Kentucky. Now they got them. Now they got him slammed up in a federal penitentiary. But guess what? On the way up there, I was saying, what happened to my life? All I ever wanted was a horse. And look what's happened to my life. I'm going to prison. Any of you guys ever go to prison? I got one. I got two. One, and then a guy and a girl. It's a guy and a girl. It's really strange going to prison, isn't it? It's scarier getting out than it is going in. And I looked around, and you know what? I had lived in all three housing projects in Louisville, Kentucky. I came from all the neighborhoods because I was a drug addict and had to score in most of these parts of town. And when I went to Terrell Federal Penitentiary, I knew about 30 guys up there. And a couple of them showed up at the A&O and they said, hey man, I weighed about 130 pounds. I've been shooting speed. And one of them said, hey man, you better be out there on a weight pile before somebody tries to marry you. I said, okay, let's do it, man. And I started lifting weights. I weighed about 130 pounds. And where's that boy all buffed up from lifting weights? Where's he at? There he is. And that's what I looked like when I got out of prison. Four times. Because we're hard learners. And something happened on the way to Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me share something with you. We all have tragedy in our lives. Everybody underneath this pavilion has had tragedy in their lives. And most of us haven't ever known how to deal with that tragedy. And what we did was we sacked that tragedy in our guts. And we stacked it on top of each other because that's what we feel. And we stacked it, and we stacked it, and we stacked it. We stacked the poverty, thank you. We stacked the poverty. We stacked the girls leaving us. We stacked the animosity. We stacked everything in here. And I went to prison, and I was a terrible husband, and I was a terrible father. And my wife never visited me in prison. And they called me to the chaplain's office one day, and I was 14 months in the prison. And I never will forget, they called me to the chaplain's office. I was a nervous wreck. I sat down, and the chaplain called me Mr. Daniels, and I knew something was wrong. And he said these words. He said, Mr. Daniels, there's been a terrible, terrible thing happening in your hometown. Your wife has been found murdered. And he said, it's an unsolved murder. And he said, you're not going to be able to go to the funeral because you're on closed custody because you have this escape where you escaped from prison. And so I couldn't go to the funeral, kid. And looking back, I want to tell you what happened. God saved me and kept me from going to that funeral. Because I don't know how, I could not handle looking at my, I had three sister-in-laws to raise my children. Because you see, I went to prison three more times. Because I couldn't look at Jimmy Daniels in the mirror. I hated who I had become. And to really honest, be honest with you, we hate ourselves more and more and more. And I got this little family waiting for me to come home. And I got a young parole officer. I got a young caseworker. And my young caseworker told me, he said, look, man, at 14 months sober, he said, look, man, he said, I'm going to get you an early parole. He said, because you're the only parent of your children. And he said, we need to get you home to them. They don't have a mother, and you're the father. And I said, yeah, right. Well, guess what? This guy gets me an early parole. I get to go out on, I got minimum custody, and I went out on the farm. A week before I'm supposed to get out on parole, they caught me sitting on a commode with my underwear down around my ankles with a needle and syringe hanging out of my arm where I've been shooting downers and I passed out. And I woke up in the hole the day I was supposed to go home to my children. And
How do you live that down, man? How do you do that? How do you walk around and still live in your own skin with that? You know, I got out of prison after I had to do all my time. I had to do all my time. I had to do 3 years in prison. Could have got out in 14 months. I went home and I got these three little kids, man. It was the saddest thing you've ever seen in your life. They don't have a mama. And they really don't have a father. And I was back in prison with 8 months for burglary. I got out of prison. I went back in prison again. 10 months later, for armed robbery on a bus drugstore, I turned into a real bad heroin, IV drug user, morphine, dilaudid, and I went to prison for armed robbing a bunch of drugstores. I remember thinking when I was in prison that time, I stayed 5 years. I remember thinking, man, I don't know what to do, man. There's something wrong with my life. And I started thinking, and I thought, man, I'm going to quit shooting drugs, man. Maybe that's what it is. So I got out of prison the third time. I said, no more shooting drugs for me. So I got a job in a dental laboratory. See, I'm a dental technician. You understand what I'm saying? I told a guy, a dental technician, and he said, you're not, but he said, you've got potential. He said, but you're a really hard worker, so I'll hire you. I'll give you $5 an hour if I take it. So I'm working in a dental lab. He drinks vodka every day. At the end of the first day, he poured himself a half a glass of vodka. I thought, damn, man, he only weighed about 120 pounds. He said, you drink? I said, ah, occasionally. He said, you want a shot of this? I said, yeah, and he poured me about like that. I said, no, man, go on, give me one like you got. I'm a man. So I start drinking vodka, y'all. At the end of 14 months, I'm drinking 2 quarts of vodka a day. I get 4 DWIs in 22 days. The same cop locks me up on the 21st and the 22nd day for wrecking cars, and I can see him looking in my window screaming, I just locked this son of a bitch up last night. How did you get out so soon? I'm going, I don't know what to do. You know how we are, man. And I wake up drunk. I wake up in jail, man. And I, you know, now I went to court, man, and I ended up getting a year, and I did my year, and I'm getting ready to get out of prison. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm getting ready to have to go home to Louisville, Kentucky, and I think I don't want to go back there because, you know, when I was arm robbing drugstores, there were about 6 or 7 in my own hometown. 3 of us got killed. They had to try to set me up to get killed one time, and another crazy guy went, and one of my buddies went, and he went to prison for 10 years. And I told him, I said, man, I told you that guy was telling on people. And I was terrified. I said, man, I'm not going home because they'll kill me. So I got a younger brother and I'm in Dallas, Texas, and I'm getting ready to get out of prison for the 4th time. So I'm trying to figure out, what do I do? And here's what comes to my head. The felonies, Jimmy. The felonies. No more felonies. So I got a brother in Dallas, Texas. I'm going to go to my brother in Dallas, Texas, and by God, I'm just going to do misdemeanors in Dallas, Texas. I go to Dallas, Texas. I meet a girl. She took me to a concert, so we moved in together. Got a job in the dental laboratory. I'm a dental technician. I don't know that. Guy said, you know how to make teeth? I said, yeah. He said, go make me a denture. I want to make him the ugliest full upper denture you ever seen in your life. He said, how many of these can you make a week? I told him, everybody doesn't go for quality, you know? It's quantity for some people. And I worked for him 14 months. 14 months was big in my life for some reason. I found you after I was out of prison for 14 months. And I lost my job. I got to get to AA quick. I got a bunch of young people. How many young people we got there? Under 6 months. Yeah. There you go. lost my girlfriend. I wrecked my car. My brother gave me that old Maverick. It was 70, and I don't have a job. I got my clothes in the back seat. I got a kitchen in my back seat. I got a pound of bologna, a pack of cheese, and a loaf of bread, you know. And I'm sleeping in that old car. And I'm thinking, what happened to my life? What happened to my life? I'm 40 years old, and I had to take a good look at my life. And I really, 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 really couldn't see what happened to my life. You know, kids were the last to know. Everybody knows but us. Driving down that old 71 Maverick, I got an old gun in the car. I get 5 years if I get caught with a gun. I can't have a gun today. Oh, I like to have a gun to protect my dog. But I got a 100-pound Akita, he can protect himself. You know? I got a dog that sounds like it weighs 500 pounds behind that gate, you know. So driving around this old 71 Maverick, I said, what happened to my life? I ended up in a field with a six-pack of beer and a headband and a pair of old running shoes and an old running shorts, and I was going to put my body back together and try to find a woman to take care of me like I used to be, like when I had all the dope, you know? But see, they don't take care of you when the dope's gone. They don't take care of you when the stuff's gone. And they don't take care of you when the money's gone. So I went running around this old field. I fell down, I collapsed on my hands and knees, and then on my face. And I started sobbing and weeping. And I never had sobbed and wept. My mother used to beat us, man, like we were dogs when we were kids. Really bad. Really, really bad. She beat us a lot. And it took me till I was 20 years old to forgive her for that. The beatings. Let me tell you what hurt more than it was to get the beatings. It hurt more to watch her give them to my brothers and sisters. And I lay there and I had a conversation with God. First one in my life. I don't remember ever praying in my life. I said, God, you know, good, sorry son of a, you know what? You mother. I said, of all the people to do this to, why have you chose me to do what you've done to me? And I started naming them off. I said, you killed my wife. You made me poor. Kept me locked up half my life. What do you want from me? You know, 2 days later, I'm knocking on the doors of a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a group called the Alpha Group in Northwest Highway and Blood Chapel Road in Dallas, Texas. I was sleeping at that old 71 Maverick. I went up the door and I was drinking. It said, I had a sign and a piece of glass that said, only 12 steps to go. I said, damn, we must be holding on a roof. And I climbed those stairs and there was 19 stairs. I thought something's wrong with that. 12 steps and they got 19. See, we're always trying to figure it out. You know those signs on the wall? Live and let live. There's two of them that they don't got at our group. Think, 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 and figure it out. It ain't on the wall, you know? Hey, yeah, they're taking think, think, think out of most of the groups in Dallas. It's not good for a young drunk, you know? I had a lady when I first overdosed grab me by my ear. I really liked her. She marched me over to that sign, and she said, you see that sign? She said, for you, it means don't, don't, don't. The sign was think, think, think. I walked into my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first meeting, everybody was sitting at that, and around that little lounge, and they were staring at me. I'm like, God, man, what's going on? They look somewhere else. Remember the first time you went? They was all staring at you, weren't they? And so I moved over, and I thought I'd read some stuff on the bulletin board or on the wall. And I read this thing, and it said, footprints. And I read it, and it said, yeah, I'll tell you where he was. I'll tell you where I was when you went through all that stuff. I was carrying you, but I didn't get it. And the lady told me, she said, you need to go in that room. I said, what's in there? She said, it's a meeting. I said, okay. So I walked in the meeting, and I stood at the door, and everybody else sitting down. I started listening to them. She said, sit down. And we don't like each other that fast. We don't like each other. You know what I'm talking about. Sit down. I said, where would you like me to sit? She said, any place you want to. So I sat down. Everybody talked. She got to me. She said, would you like to say something? And I said, what do you want me to say? And she said, any damn thing you want to, buddy. I said, okay. Now I got her going, you know. I got what I wanted from her. I got a ride, you know. I said, see that little guy over there whining, and pissing, moaning about not having a father? She said, okay. I said, telling some of us never even had a father. I said, what do you think about that? She said, shut up. That's cross talk. And I thought to myself, you have gone too far, Jimmy Daniels. You have gone too far. Because all I wanted to do now was disappear. Because I knew I couldn't say anything back to that lady. That meeting closed. I shut out that door and I shut down those stairs. I'm about halfway down them and I got a hand reached for my shirt, pulled me back. He said, hey, buddy, would you like to have something to eat? I thought, hell yeah, man, I'm starving, man. I'm sleeping out there in that 71 Maverick. And I tell him that, but he was a little guy that was pissing, moaning, whining about not having a father. He said, well, come on up. You want to talk? I went up, we talked for a while. He said, oh, man, he said, you know, he said, if you come back tomorrow night, I think that must have been a Thursday, because there's going to be a Saturday night, they were going to have a party, and it was going to be AA's anniversary. So I hung around there drunk and loaded for a couple of days, and I'd see him, and then he took me to that AA function where you got food. In Dallas back then, they had a lot of food deals, and that's how I ate a lot. And so I went to that function with him, and I was sitting on the end, and he sat beside me, and a guy named Jerry Jones talking. And he said, you know, he said, I always compared my insides to everybody else's outsides. And I thought, I can relate to that. And my sponsor, they said, would anybody like to have one of these? And I didn't know what the hell he's talking about. He shoved me out. Go get one. I said, hell no. I thought, no, I can't go up front of all these people, man. Get that. He said, go on, get it, man. And I went up there and I got what we call a desire chip. And everybody went nuts. Thought I was the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know what I mean? Everybody came up to me afterwards. Everybody shaking my hand. Hey, man, I got it here. Guess what? I'm sponsoring a guy right now, and he's got 11 days. And I met him at a meeting when he had 3 days. And I went, and I couldn't see him anywhere, because he's the guy that used to be on the phone when I'd order my Italian food. And he, over the period of 5 or 6 years while I ate Italian food, he bottled out. And he called me. He said, man, will you help me? I said, yeah. So I met him at the group. Now, it was just down to the last person talking. And I heard this voice sit behind all these people, because I don't like it. I look around, I can't find it. So I'm sitting there pissed off, because, you know, this guy says, yeah, my name's Nick, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober 3 days. And the whole place erupted. You know how I had to do when this person's 2 or 3 days sober? And he said, I feel this and I feel that. And there's only one person who's going to get to talk next. I said, hey, my name's Jimmy Daniels and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sitting here pissed off because my sponsee didn't show up. And that was him just got through talking. And they just roared, you know. And I talked to him for about 20 minutes on the way here, and he's doing really good, man. And he said, Jimmy, every time I go to a meeting, he said, they take what I talk about and have a meeting about it. I said, isn't that incredible, man? Isn't that the sweetest thing you've ever heard in your whole life? He said, man, he said, they think I'm great, man. He said, this is a hell of a deal, man. He said, I'm getting well, my mama loves me. You know, I thought, my God, it works. You know, when you got 30 years of sobriety, You got to see some of that every now and then. You understand what I'm saying? You know, you built treatment centers, you built this, and you got this triple digit sobriety, and you see a guy that's got 11 days, and man, your heart just spins. And I'm calling him on the way back, on the way home. I told that guy that night, he said, no, I met him the next night on the Monday night. And he said, what do you think about what happened to you last night? I said, well, what happened to me, man? He said, we took a desire chip. I said, okay. He said, that means you're going to try to get sober, right? I said, hell, I don't know. You made me take it. You shoved me out. You shoved me out there. He goes, okay. So I went to the meeting the next morning because I'm sleeping in the car. I ain't got no place else to go anyway. And that's the best way you can get here if you don't have any place else to go. And I walked through the halls of AA because there was 4 meetings a day in the group I came in. And I passed the guy, and the guy said, "Are you drinking, man?" I said, "Yeah, I am." I thought, he said, "Do you know what we do here?" I said, "Man, I'm getting around about figuring it out." Because I figured out y'all don't drink, you know. I thought, I don't know if I can do that or not. He said, "Well, make a commitment. You know what a commitment is?" I didn't even know what a commitment is. I said, "Hell yeah, I know what a commitment is." He said, "Well, make a commitment to don't drink," and he walked off, and I never saw him again. And the next morning, I thought, I'm going to try to do this. And I didn't drink that day. And I didn't drink the next day. And I met my sponsors, and I met the guy there that showed me out and took me the deal, and I knew that I had to get a sponsor. But you know, when you get here and you've been where I've been, and you got those dying ears, like I talked about in the 12 and 12 and about the first step, and there's only 5 pages in the 12 and 12 about the first step. It talks about those dying ears. We hear things nobody else heard. You see, my boy Nick, 11 days and 3 days and 2 days sober, my boy Nick is hearing things nobody else hears. My boy Nick is hearing the message from those people that are carrying the message. And here's that message that people like me, with 30 years of sober, and like he said, "I want to do like you, man. I want to speak in Cancun. I want to speak in Aruba." I said, "Man, maybe it'll come, you know." I said, "But you know, it just comes. It just comes with the church." And my sponsor, my buddy, I knew I needed a sponsor, and so I asked him that night. I said, "Man, I know I got a house." I took him aside. I said, "I want to talk to you." I said, "Will you be my sponsor?" And if he said no, I would have left and never ever come back to AA. I think that takes that much guts to ask somebody to help us, because we're not really good at asking people for help. And he said, "Yeah, I'll sponsor you, but I want you to do something for me. You willing to work with me? May I work with you?" I said, "Well, yeah, probably." He said, "What do you think about not having sex for a year?" I went, "What? What are you talking about, man? What's that got to do with anything?" He said, "Well, you're all over these women here, man." I said, "Yeah, man, I really like that. You know, I mean, I showed up and you had what I wanted, a bunch of pretty women. They say if you have what we want and are willing to go to any length to get it, man, I'm going for the pretty women first." You know? And the good-looking women are going for the handsome guys. It's nature. I said, "Man, I don't understand what you're talking about." And a little voice said, "Man, what he's saying," he said, "you know what?" He said, "You might not even be able to do it, man." He said, "It's been 25 years since you've done without drugs and alcohol. I don't remember doing it without drugs and alcohol." And I looked at him and I thought, he said, "Well, how about just doing it until you get to the 11th step?" I thought, "Man, maybe that was 3 or 4 or 3 months. Maybe I'll do that." You know how it took me? How long took me to get to 11 steps? 11 months. And I did that. And he sponsored me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took us a year. And I'm going to share this with you. If I'd have been sponsored like some people sponsor and think they can take you through this program in 30 days and help have you out there 12-stepping, if you'd had me for a sponsor when I was 30 years, 30 days sober, we both would have been drunk and shooting drugs. And slowly, I went through those 12 steps and found out what they meant. And the miracles happened along the way. Probably the first one was when I was in a meeting and a guy said, you think you got this alcoholism, and if you think you have the phenomenon of craving, he says, if you'll get on your knees and ask God to keep you sober in the morning and get on your knees at night and thank God, the craving will go away. That little boy said, man, you don't go for some weak crap like that. Another little boy said, man, you've gone for weak crap than that. You better try that. And I started praying, man. And I don't know, it took 2 or 3 weeks or a month. I have not wanted to take a drink or do any mind-altering chemicals since I was 5 or 6 weeks sober. That is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the only way we can live is with the phenomenon of craving gone. That is the freedom that Alcoholics Anonymous gives. That's the thing that makes you and I holy, is that we get free and totally free, and we can be around alcohol or not be around it, and we can go, and if we got to go 12-step somebody, we can be around alcohol. If we work in a bar, we can be around alcohol, and we don't have... I know a girl 12 years sober still a bartender. And that's the main, incredibly powerful thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that we get set free. Free. You know, I didn't know what freedom was. I thought when I got out of the penitentiary that I was going to be free. You know what? Every time I got out, I was in more difficult bondage because the drug addiction, the alcoholism got worse and worse. The last time I got out of prison, I was probably the worst shape that I've ever been. The worst shape I had really ever been was the few days before I found Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've been on drugs and alcohol, and I did not have to kick an alcohol problem or a drug problem. And you took it away from me in 5 weeks. And because that's gone in my life, I go... And I start to build my life. But let me tell you some few little miracles that happened in my life. I was sleeping in a car. I was going to AA, and I heard a guy say, hey, you know, the only thing you need to do to be a businessman, have a customer. I thought, man, Dwayne Taylor, we both got fired at that dental clinic. He got fired for being lazy. I got fired for stealing the guy's gold. He told me if I wanted his dentures, I could come get them. So I went over to his place, and I said, man, you want to let me have your dentures? You said I could have them. He said, where are you going to make them? I said, don't worry about it. I had a buddy who was a dental technician. He let me make the dentures over to his lab. First denture I made was an upper partial with four clasps on it. I didn't have a buck, $1. So I didn't have a clasp wire. Was a buck a foot. So I was around his place over there. I looked around. I saw these paper clips. And I put paper clips on my first partial. Paper clips for clasps. The lady came back in 2 or 3 weeks and the paper clips had turned black. All the way up into the pink of the partial. He called me over there and he said, you're in trouble. I said, what happened? He said, this is what happened. I was looking at that partial. I said, my God. People have said, I said, man, she must be allergic to metal or something, man. I said, look here, I've got some special stuff. I can fix this. He said, you better be able to. Well, guess what? I got $90 for the partial. $90 to a drunk sleeping in a car is a fortune. So I went and got me some clasp wire. Probably got 2 or 3 foot of it, you know, dollar a foot. Fixed that up, cleaned it up, and turned it from a tramp to a businessman in 3 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, I had a customer, and so I had a dental laboratory. And if you don't know who I was, Jimmy Daniels, I was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I'm a businessman. And now I'm just a commode hugging alcoholic
that didn't love drugs.
When I found out that I was an alcoholic, I was on my way, and I have never looked back. Now, that's a powerful thing that's happened in my life. I met Jim when I was, I don't know, I'm sober, were we 2 or 3 years sober? I don't know. He said I told him something he never forgot. I know we were playing cards, and I said, man, I didn't know you could do stuff like this sober. Play cards, kid. Come on. Sober? What? And we've been friends ever since. And everybody that I've found to be a friend, I've never found it necessary to shove one of them aside. Now, a lot of people have turned out to be just acquaintances, but I got a lot of friends. And I've got some people on this one hand, and Thomas Merton says, if you've got friends in your life and they fit on one hand, at the end of your life, you consider yourself a really good friend that had a lot of friends. Let me tell you what I got, kids. I got 5 people that I can call and tell them anything I've done, and they won't judge me. That's the trick in friendship. The person won't judge you. And he won't be like this if you have a day where you're having a problem. You say, I feel depressed. And they look at you and say, you can't find something to be grateful for? He won't do that to you. Your friend will say, hey man, well I get like that too, man. Let's talk about it. Let's go hang out. Let's go do something. Let's go get a cup of coffee. Let's go to Starbucks and watch a girl in the shorts, man. You know? I mean, come on, man. We're real, you know? We're human. Probably the next thing that happened that was anywhere near anything was that I got my fourth step done. I got the first step in a month, the second step in a month, and the third step in a month, and it took me 8 or 9 months to get the fourth step. And we got any of those people here? Give me a hand. Come on. There you go. I know it gets you smiling. And you know why? For most of us, we read too far in the book before it says we tell another human being our whole life story. And we're not going to do that. But we're ashamed of what we've done. And we don't think we can be forgiven for the ugly stuff that we've done. And then we come, you know, there's some great language in the book, and the one I love as much as any other one-liner is, we stood at the turning point. Now, I got a flash for you. I've been at about 1,000 turning points in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we get to the turning point with step 4. And then we get to where we've got to do it or we've got to leave. And then we finally get the courage. And the way I got the courage, I heard a lady come through, a step speaker, and she said the words I heard caused me to write a 4-step. And then I heard a lady say, give me the words to write that 4-step. And those words will tell your 2 or 3 deepest, darkest secrets you'll have done a good one. And the first lady said, here's how you do a 4-step. You put ass in chair and pen in hand. You write it, kid. You write it. Just write it. They're standing in line and they hate to listen to it. Because they really want to have something in it that would be exciting. See the old sponsors out there going like this. Old sponsors going like this, you know? We want something different. See, here's what I do. Here's what I do to my young sponsees. Here's what I'm going to do to Nick when we get to the 4-step and the 5th step. I'm going to tell Nick. I'm going to say, Nick, this is what I want to tell. And these are my 2 or 3 deepest, darkest secrets. And you know what Nick will do? He'll blow it all out. I'll get every bit of it. And that's how it's built. And it's built no other way. Now I got a flash for you. It's easy, everybody do it. If it's easy, you probably wouldn't have... How many people got here with 30 years sobriety? We got 3. How many people we got with 20? Two. Look around, y'all kids. Where do they go? Where do they go? I'll tell you what happened to me. Did any of you ever hear that thing in AA where they say you go to your birthday party and there's a lot of people in the first 5 years, but that place between 5 and 10 years, we don't know where they go? Yeah, we've got a lot of hands shaking yes. I got to be 5 years sober, and I got to that place in my life, and I knew that the newness had worn off, and I knew that I had to do something special to keep me working for the next 5 years. See, AA gave me common sense. Now, what I did was I had this little dental laboratory, and I had got to where I had enough customers that from 3 days sober to 5 years sober, I saved $50,000. Now, I'm getting ready to buy me a little new Mercedes Benz, because I want all the girls to say, see that guy right there? He came here sleeping in a car, and you see that little car he's driving? He owns that, and it's paid for. It was a $50,000 car. But you know what happened on the way to the $50,000 car? I was sponsoring a football player named Hollywood. And Thomas looked at me one day and he said, "Hey, Jimmy," he said, "I know a lot of football players and they got them little Mercedes Benzes and they ain't got no place to park them." I thought, "Oh my God, I got to buy a house for my car." No. And so I heard about Clancy and, you know, Clancy. And I heard about Joe McClaney. I heard about those boys that started their own treatment centers. And I come to find out they didn't even start there. 1987, I started a treatment center in Dallas, Texas called the Ethel Daniels Foundation. Ethel Daniels is my little wife who died November 8, 1971. And I watched that little treatment center grow from two people to where about 5,000 or 6,000 people went through it after 17 years. It closed in 2006. And it had its season. And lots of people got sober there. Anybody here with a name of the Ethel Daniels Foundation? There's one right here, y'all. Yeah. And let me tell you what happens when you do something like that. I didn't do it for that purpose. Here's the reason I did it. People ask me after years and years and years, why'd you do that? It took me years to figure out why I did it, even after I closed the center. Two lines. The promises. You will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in your fellows. The other one is, what have you done for the least of mine? What have you done for the least of mine? And so it got real simple. You turned me from a tramp and a thief and a liar into a decent person. And kids, that's all we get to be, is decent people. That's all, that's about as high as it gets. You know, I'm not perfect. You know, but I'm decent. And I try to live a good, godly oriented life. And I still do the things you taught me to do. I still pray for those who disciple and use me. You know where that prayer is if you're new and you're young? You've heard praying for people who disciple and use you. Have you heard that? It's at the bottom of 66 and the top of 67. And what they're saying is, God's talking to a sponsee. He said, "Now you wouldn't want to harm a sick person, would you? The only way an alcoholic is going to go for that is if they're a sick person and they're under him. You get what I'm saying? I'll pray for this poor, sorry sack of crap, you know?" And that's how we learn to pray for people. We got to be above them for the first year anyway. And then we get it, man. And then we get it. Because you know what? It works like this. If we don't forgive, we don't get it. It's just that simple. I'm not preaching a sermon because we don't listen to sermons. It's in our book. You know, isn't it? I got me a couple of years, yeah, myself, so I keep on going, you know. I got my girl smiling at me, Michael. And that's as high as it gets, it's sober and decent. And let me tell you what I did on the way to 15, 20 years sobriety. I got my family back. Let me tell you where it is in the book. It's at the top of page 18, upper left-hand corner, and this is what it describes. It describes what you and I have left in our past. One of those lines is this. Warped lives of blameless children. See, I was a warped life of a blameless children. I had three children. I was sober 4 or 5 years, and I wanted them to treat me like I was sent from heaven. They still didn't like me. You know how long it took me to get my kids back? As long as I was gone, 12 years. I was 12 years sober, still going back to Louisville, Kentucky, renting suites in hotel rooms and having my grandkids down to stay with me. My kids never invited me to stay at their house until I was 12 years sober. So, I mean, you know, got a flash for you. It ain't about them. It's about us. Here's the other line. I'm getting close to it. Now, I go listen to a lot of preachers now. One of the lines in the book says, most of us go back to church. I'm 29. And I hear these guys saying, they say, look, I'm going to be wrong. And I told my preacher, I said, man, every time one of them says that, man, he speaks about an hour and a half. You know? And the other line is, I read one day. See, kids, we talk about what happened to us. I read one day. We think that a man that sets out on a spiritual journey that does not include his family just might not be so spiritual after all. So you sit me on a road to find God and find a spiritual way to live. Now I'll tell two stories and I'm going to close. Number one, I hated my mother till I was 20 years old. I got a new sponsor. I want to ask to be my sponsor, so I can't do it to hate your mother. But you hate her too, if you got what I got for her. He said, I'm going to talk about Buddy. He started calling me Buddy. I said, my name ain't Buddy. He said, well, it is to me. He said, anyway, I can't sponsor you. And then he said, look, here's the only way I'll sponsor you. Go home, read step 8 and 12 and 12, first two pages, and send me a 4-step on your mother, and I want the end of it to be, I was a bad son. And give me your phone number and give me your address and don't call me, I'll call you. And I thought, let me get away from this show, yo, before I erupt. I got out of that meeting, I thought, does he think that I am going on? You know what? I walked 20 feet. We was up at Lake Murray. This is a men's conference. I walked 20 feet. I see a buddy of mine. I said, hey, man, you bring your 12 and 12? He said, yeah. I said, can I borrow it? I did my mother's 4-step before I left there. I went home and mailed it to him. 2 days later, he called me. You know what he said? 3 days, 4 days, whatever. He said, you did good, kid. Sweetest words I've ever did. Ever. He said, you did good, kid. He said, when can you do it? I said, I'm not going home until, that was in March. I said, I can't go home until Thanksgiving. Because you know what to do, don't you? I said, yeah, because I've been to the graveyard before. I went to my mother's grave 20 years old, and I was still in her grave, and I was going to tell her about my brothers and sisters. And let me tell you what happened. I broke down like an old dog, just like I had laying in that field before I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sobbed and I wept for my mother's life. And my mother had one of the most saddest stories. You think I got a story? But her life, my mother probably was 20 years old before she had a piece of meat wasn't ground up. Always I saw my mother in flip-flops. I saw my mother hold her hand over her mouth because she didn't have any teeth. Christmas time, this year, I went to my drugstore, which I use as a grocery store, drugs, pictures, everything. They call me Mr. Daniels, and that's why I go back. I love it. Mr. Daniels. You know, I ain't used to that. I sobbed and I wept for her life. But I went to that drugstore and I saw a lady standing in line like this. And what I asked her, I walked up and I asked her, I said, "Hey, baby, you want some tea?" She said, "Well, hell yeah." I said, "Here's my phone number." Within 5 or 6 days, I had 2 front teeth in that lady's mouth. She was smiling like you couldn't believe it. 2 weeks later, she called and asked me if she borrowed $200. I said, "No, I can't do that." You know? But I knew that lady was like my mother. That stuff, kids, that stuff goes with us for the rest of our lives. For the rest of our lives. Well, this is a life story. Never knew who my father was. I thought my name was Jimmy Daniels. I went looking for my father when I was 25 years old. And my uncle down the country, he told me, he said, "Son, I don't know why the Lord told you, but that guy you think's your father wasn't your father." I said, "Then who was my father?" He said, "Well, your father, his name was Albert Underwood." I said, "Well, then I want to go see him." I never will forget this. I don't know why he chose these words, but this is what he said. It was in 1967. He said, "If you go see him," he said, "you'll have to dig him up because he died about 6 months ago." And I took that, and for the next 30 years, I held that against my mother. I told my sister, she said, "Jimmy, I always knew it." I said, "What'd she say?" She said, "Well, he'll find out who he is one day." And that's where my mother was. That's how she, see, that's the kind of life she had. You know, that's a sad kind of life she had. And I took that and lived with it. Stuck it down there with everything else. Last month, not this previous month, because I did the steps of another group, but the previous month, every February, I speak every month at a group in Arlington, Texas called the Primary Purpose Group. And there's a lady there, and she asked me, she said, "Do you like me to do your genealogy?" Because I tell this story every time I go to the steps. I said, "No, I don't care about this stuff. I ain't got no genealogy. Hell, I don't have one." I said, "Well, nobody in our family's got a genealogy. We don't care about that crap." I went the last week or last month, and she said these words. She said, "You know why I think I found your brothers and sisters?" I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "I got a telephone number here, and I think it's your sister." She said, "You want to call it?" I said, "Hell yeah." I called that number for 2 days. Nobody answered. And I was not going to call it anymore. And I was headed to work on a Friday morning. I tried it one more time. And a lady answered. I said, "Are you Rita Myers?" She said, "Yes, that's me." I said, "Are you sitting down?" She said, "No." I said, "I'm your brother." She said, "Oh, my God." And I told her the story. I said, "I can tell you where your father's buried." Because when I confronted my mother with this story, this is what she told me. She said, "Well, if you want to see him, he's heard buried out there in South Carrollton." I said, "Your father's buried in South Carrollton." She said, "Yeah." So we've been on the phone for a month. And guess what, kids? I don't have to wonder what my father looked like. So I'll tell you this story first. I've known what my real father looked like since the day I walked through these doors. And that's the father that you and I get. Let me tell you what. Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be mother, and you're going to be father, if it's not even in your genome. And I found a sister. She said, "Guess what? You got 3 brothers." My father died of alcoholism at 47 years old. My father, some of you guys will know about this, won the Medal of Honor in the Second World War. I told a dentist of mine, I said, "Hey man, my father won the Medal of Honor." He said, "You better be sure about that." He said, "There's a lot of paperwork and everything goes with that." He said, "Check it out." So I was talking to my sister Rita. We text every night. She said, "Good night, brother." I said, "Good night, sister." And she said, "I'm really glad I got an older brother. I'm the oldest of 7 kids. I have 4 brothers
two sisters, and one sister's dead, and one of those brothers has died too. And I sent them a birth certificate with their father's name on my birth certificate. And never knew I was going to find who my real father was. Never knew that. So let me tell you what, kids. You're going to get a life. And your life is going to be like a layer cake. And you're going to have one layer, two layers. You can even make it as big as a wedding cake. And you're going to have three layers. And you might find there's going to be a cherry on top of it. And you might find someday somebody picks that cherry off, runs off with it. But you're going to find out that somebody keeps putting a cherry on top of it. Because there was a cherry on top of a cake that I got confronted with last month. My father, knowing I'm father, knowing what he looked like, knowing he died, is now wrong. Thank you for having me.
Any of you want to talk?